I first heard this gentleman speak at the 164 on Tuesday night, and while he's young in recovery, one might have said that was quite a while ago. He made a lot of sense, and he came straight out of the book speaking of recovery. And you could see the light in his eyes change, and I certainly did, and I respect everything he said. I think he's a very good picture of the big book. He carries the message and uses words if necessary. So tonight, I would like to introduce
to you from the 164 group, Mr. Will L.
Well, I'm an alcoholic. I like this new podium, by the way. It's nice. My sobriety date is July 13, 2010. I have a sponsor, and I have the beautiful privilege of sponsoring others. What I'm going to do is basically tell you in a general way what happened, what it was like, and what it's like today. I was born in Brandon, Florida, not too far from here. Two amazing parents. You know, I couldn't have asked for anything better. And if you had asked me a couple years ago what I thought, I'd have told you anything but that statement right there. I've got an older sister, older brother, and a younger brother. Some of which could be or couldn't be members of a fellowship. Who knows? It's not for me to decide. But they don't have the same kind of problems about things that I do. Some people say it's a genetic thing. Some people say different things. What I do know is that grandparents on both sides were alcoholic in theirs. You know, so it's whether it is or it isn't, that's not why I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I can't control what I drink, how much I'm going to drink, and when I'm going to stop. And if I'm going to stay stopped. I had a great childhood. You know, my parents were always involved. They always did everything and more as for what they could do. I was very active as a child. You know, I played soccer, did sports, ran. You know, I did all kinds of stuff. And my parents were always right there every step of the way, supporting me in whatever I wanted to do. You know, standing by me when things were bad and taking no credit when things were good. And, you know, I truly admire my parents heavily, you know, and today I've got such an amazing relationship with them. It's pretty impressive. But I'll get to that. You know, ever since I was a little kid, I've always kind of had an unhealthy curiosity with wanting more of whatever it was. I have what I consider a disease of more. There's nothing that's enough. I always want more, no matter how much I have. It's where's mine? Look at what he has. And it's put me in a lot of different kind of situations. And you know, I always kind of skated on the edge of different things. You know, I have an incredible knack for stopping the instant before I'm about to get in serious trouble. And there's a couple times when I didn't, and my parents kind of stepped in and kind of saved me from the consequences that would have inevitably happened. And, you know, it may have prolonged things, it may not have. Who knows? Pretty much, middle school was good. I always had a good ability to making friends and talking with people. Somehow I have pretty decent social skills. And but I always felt like I was missing something. You know, like, I was always able to be friends with everybody, but I was always incredibly wrapped up in myself. I was petrified at what I thought you thought of me. That's what ran me, is what you thought of me. And I was petrified of making a fool of myself, so I didn't attempt to do a lot of things because I lived in fear that I would make a fool of myself and everybody would remember it for the rest of their lives. So kind of going on through like elementary school, middle school, stuff like that. I was very lazy in school. I didn't want to do it. It had nothing to do with that I couldn't do it. I didn't understand it. It's that I thought there were better things to do in the day than to go sit at school. So that kind of led me to kind of skating on the edge with the people that did the kind of things that I did. Because if you associate yourself with people that are on like the up and up and honor society and all that, they look at you like, what are you doing, dude? You know, they kind of make you wonder about yourself. So I circle myself with people that kind of did what I did. You know the saying, like, water seeks its own level? That's what I did. And the first time kind of anything really happened was like somewhere between 7th and 8th grade. Me and a bunch of friends kind of started partaking in some of like the early things that adolescents do when nobody's around. And the entire summer we partook in a couple different things. And at the end of the summer, we all got caught. And we all had this, like, kind of like a family intervention with, like, all the parents and all the kids and all that that were involved. And I was grounded for pretty much the whole next school year. And I was pissed. Because, like, my friends got off easy. And that kind of scared me for a while. I didn't really do anything for probably till sophomore year of high school, something like that. But little by little, I kind of started hanging out with the people that put me in similar positions that I was in before. And I started doing some different things, you know, and it became, little by little, it was casual fun, and then it became frequent fun, and then it became every weekend, all weekend long, fun. And then it became every day, all day, fun, to where that's what ruled my life. It was waking up, deciding whether I had what I was looking for the day or if I didn't. And if I didn't, I wouldn't do anything until I did. Basically, my day started once I had the things that I was looking for. And it ran my life for a long time because it took a lot of my attention and thought to kind of keep track of all the things that come with that kind of stuff. All of the phone calls, all of the seeking, all of the looking, all of the lies and manipulation and things that you have to do the things that we do. And keeping everything straight, it's like a full-time job. You know, trying to remember what you told to who, trying to remember that if two people get in the same room, to not make sure to bring up certain things, because then they'll, like, one person will say one thing to another, and they'll be like, well, that's not what he told me. So I was wrapped up in so much that it ran my life. It controlled me. I lost interest in everything that I wanted to do, everything that I had drive to do, and it was replaced by things other than alcohol. That became my world. It became my everything. You know, and it was my alpha, it was my omega. And the first time I had to, and that went on for a while, and it put me in a lot of crazy situations, a lot of things that anyone in their right mind would never contemplate doing, because I was not of sound mind. I was insane. I was very, very sick. And I was so sick, I didn't know I was sick. I thought I was great. My problem was everybody else. And if they would just leave me alone and let me do the things that I want to do, life would be great. You know, if I could just get all the things that I wanted, I could go to work on time, I could show up, I could be there for the family on those, like, Easters and stuff. As long as I had everything that I wanted, life was great. Or so I thought. And It put me in a mental state that was so paralyzing, and it just, all hope was lost, all confidence was gone. My disease took everything that I ever had. It pretty much took it from me in spades. It pretty much destroyed my relationship with anybody I ever knew. It destroyed my relationship that I had or what I thought of myself. It destroyed and bankrupted me morally, spiritually, and physically. It put me in such a low, and the book refers to it as pitiful and comprehensible demoralization, because that's absolutely what it was for me. Because I had such depression, and just I lived in the poor me, and and throughout active addiction, like, there was every reason why I should not do what I was doing, but all sound logic and sane thought process went out the window because I was insane. Things other than alcohol were as important to me as food, water, and shelter are to most normal people. I would get what I needed before I paid any bills, if I paid them at all. And it got to such a point that I was pawning all my belongings and everybody else's belongings and anything that I could find of value. Anything that had any monetary value, I didn't care what it was, if it was jewelry, family heirlooms, silver flatware from like five generations ago. It didn't matter what it was. What I wanted was more important because I was selfish and self-centered. Because I didn't care about anybody else but myself. And that kind of came to a head. I remember exactly where I was sitting when I realized that this is not normal. I can't live like this. Just that kind of, like an epiphany of what's been going on and everything. And just I can't do this. There has to be a better way. And I went to my parents and told them, like, hey, I've got a freaking problem. They're like, yeah, no duh. And we're glad you finally realized this. We've known for a long time. I mean, there's only so many times you could have conversations of, do you know where this is? Or have you seen this? Or are you okay? What's wrong with you? You're slurring your words. There's only so many times you can have a conversation where somebody realizes that there's something wrong with you. And so the first time I went to treatment was, they gave me a choice of doing the work and joining a 12-step fellowship or what I thought was the easier, softer way. And it led to a 4-year journey of being basically chained to a substance. I mean, that, plain and simple, that's what it was. And it was it was good and bad at the same time. It gave me the ability to get kind of some stability in my life. It made it so that I could kind of function somewhat and be able to show up for work and not be late and have to worry about going out and finding things, coming back, and just all of that stuff. It took that away. But what it also took back, even worse, was whatever amount of self-confidence I had left, whatever amount of hope and all those things. It took everything and more than it ever had. And it got to the point where, once again, I was like, I can't do this. I gotta figure it out. So I basically went to a private doctor, and we worked out a system to say goodbye. And That was a sad day. And little by little, it kind of went out of my life. And it wasn't, I didn't go to a fellowship or any of that. And, you know, things were good for a while. You know, I was selling cars, making good money. And I was busy. I was working every day. I was working like 70 hours a week. And it afforded me the ability to pay for a lot of things that a 20-year-old should never be able to pay for. It led me to believe that I had the world in my hand. It gave me a huge false sense of pride, entitlement, and ego, and all kinds of different things. Because I was pretty decent at it, you know, and it gave me the ability to kind of do a lot of things. And one of the things that gave me the ability to do was kind of have cocktails with the guys over at the bar after work. And you know how they say your disease kind of sits outside, waits for you while you're gone? That's absolutely what happened. Because I thought my disease was particular to a particular type of substance. That it didn't include alcohol, that every single thing was separate because I didn't have a problem with alcohol at that point. So I was like, why can't I drink? And so I did. And in the span of about 6 months, I went from drinking like a normal person, having one or two and no thoughts of anything else. I didn't sit and fixate on how much I was going to drink, try and control my drinking. It became very quickly and very apparent that I had an unhealthy relationship with alcohol. And I started not being able to show up at work because I would go out drinking all night the night before and was so hungover that I couldn't show up for work the next day. You know, and I played the I'm sick card or my grandmother died or whatever. And then I kind of ran out of relatives. And they started asking questions that I wasn't able to answer. I didn't have an explanation. I had no idea what was wrong with me other than I had a mental obsession beyond my control. I obsessively thought and compulsively drank. Just like before, it took precedence over anything else. I went from being pretty normal, being able to show up and do that kind of stuff, and to drinking pretty much every day. You know, I'd wake up, I would drink till about 4 or 5 in the morning and then go to bed, and then I'd be up around like 2 or 3 in the afternoon, which was right about the time happy hour started. So, and I was fired at that point, and I was on unemployment, so I really had no drive to like go out and find a job or anything. And so what I did for the next 18 months was I proceeded to drink every single day and every single night. And, you know, and I can kind of joke about this now, but like there's been instances that have kind of come up they always seem to come up at holidays or family events. When, do you remember when? And all of the well, thank God that's not you today. And I was a blackout drinker from pretty much from day one. I we get to the bar about 3 o'clock, and then about 4, I was blacked out. And it wasn't that I was drinking to blackout. I was drinking because that's the only way I knew how to drink. I didn't know any other way. I didn't want to know any other way. And it left me, and I used to always kind of joke about this with my younger brother, because he used to go out and go out to the bars with me too. And we'd play darts a lot together and kind of different, play pool and stuff like that. And he would always kind of razz me, like, because like somebody would come up to me like, hey, how you doing? And like after they'd leave, I'd look at my brother, I'm like, who the hell is that? And he would be like, you don't remember him? You sat at the bar and had like a 4-hour conversation with this dude last night. It's like, oh yeah, really? And I mean, there was countless instances like that. I had the ability and privilege of making an amends to one of the bars that I used to go to yesterday, last night. And it was interesting because she went and had to look up my name, and she said there was so much information that she didn't have time to read it, but that I was banned for life, and that thank God you're sober now, because you would have died. And that's absolutely the case, because anytime that I drank, I was given a false sense of my abilities. I thought I was smarter, faster, stronger, could drive better, was wittier, better looking, taller, stronger, all that. Like, that's what alcohol did for me. It basically made me who I thought that I wanted to be, or thought that I was. And the consequences, or like the pros and cons for it at that point, in my mind, it was a good deal. And it was so far from that. I mean, it was insane because, like, I was always wrecking something, backing into something, getting hurt somehow. You know, like, I fell off balconies. I've driven my car into signs and telephone poles, and I almost killed on September 26th of 2010. No, it was 2009, sorry. I drove into a tree going about 70 miles an hour with my younger brother and his best friend in the car. There's a guy in the rooms that talks about seconds and inches. This was absolutely that scenario. An inch to the left, inch to the right, we would all been dead. And that wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to almost die countless times. You couldn't scare me with the facts of my problem. And it got to the point where I was going to die. My parents said goodbye to me. They said, we can't watch you die. So we're going to have to end it now before you do. Because you will die. And they're like, you have two choices. Get out of our life or go to treatment. And I kind of pondered it for a little bit, you know, and I went to treatment, and I fought it and bucked it, but I did. And I a while back, right after it was Thanksgiving night, I had the ability to kind of go back to my dad and make amends to him for kind of how I treated him when I went to treatment. And that was one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had. I'll get more to that in a second. So I went to treatment, and they told me I was a special case, because I started an outpatient, and when I did the assessment, because I like to think of myself as a social drinker, and I was so far from that. I thought I drank socially because I went to the bar and drank. Never mind the fact that I sat over at the corner, didn't really do much, but I was a social drinker, damn it. And they were talking to me like, well, how much are you drinking, and like, what are you doing, and all that stuff. And even at my best attempt of minimizing, he said, what were you doing, trying to die? I said, no. What makes you say that? He goes, dude, like, what is wrong with you? And you think you're good? You don't think you have a problem? Okay, sounds like you do, buddy. We got a place for you. And so I started an outpatient, went to outpatient, and I did so well that I went to residential. And it was, like, it's comical now, but, like, I thought I was so slick and, like, faking the drug test and doing this and that. And everybody knew it but me. I was only fooling myself. And so I went to residential and I did that. You know, and for the first 2 weeks I was in there, I didn't really want to do anything, didn't want to have any involvement there. I was basically buying time to figure out what I was going to do. You know, and some people kind of, I forgot what the word they use for, but they, some people kind of use treatment as like a drying out period so that they can drop their tolerance and then like, go back out. You know, I mean, so like I had all kinds of crazy stuff running through my head, like insurance is going to cancel out, I'm going to like get my car, I'm going to go somewhere away and like, it'll be good. Like, I just, you know, I did it wrong. I'll do it right this time. I just got out of hand. It was this situation or that. Or whatever it was. You know, it was always somebody else's fault for the reasons that I drank the way that I drank. It was anything, anyone else's fault but my own. I would not take responsibility for anything I did. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous a very immature child. And, I had a large sense of entitlement of, don't you know who I am? Why are you going to tell me what to do? Do you not see? I'm like a big deal. And they very politely told me that that is not the case and keep coming back. And so I went to treatment, and when I left treatment, it was recommended that I go to a halfway house. And I was like, no, I'm not doing that. Like, I want to go here, go there. And then I guess my counselor got a hold of my parents and told them, like, hey, you shouldn't let them come back to your house. I was like, and I found out about it. I was pissed. And in so many ways, told him a little bit about himself and told him how wrong he was. And it was the best decision I've ever made besides agreeing to go to treatment. Because I'm a person that can kind of get disconnected from things pretty easily, and if I had gone back to my parents' house, I would not be sitting here talking to you guys today. That is a fact. And the experiences that I gained in being at the halfway house, because there's always somebody around, there's always somebody to talk to, there's people that are trying to do the same things that you're doing. So it made it a lot easier to, when I didn't want to go to a meeting, to say, you know what, whatever, you guys are going, I'll ride with you, whatever. And I did the same for them when they didn't want to go, you know. And it, you know, we had so much fun at the house. You know, two of the guys that I live with are in the back, and we had water balloon fights, we'd have movie nights, we cooked together. Some people continue to eat out of plastic trays that say Hungry Man on the top. But, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, right? And, when I was in treatment, I got a sponsor that was placed, God placed my sponsor in my life for a reason. He came from Brandon, he did all the kind of the same things that I did. He felt what I felt and he thought what I thought. And he's found a new way to live. And he used to be involved with the people that I was involved with way back when. And he came to a meeting that he hadn't been to in over a year. He randomly kind of, he saw me pick up my white chip and he came over and started talking to me. And he asked me, like, how I was doing and stuff, and he asked me if I had a sponsor, and I was like, yeah, I got one, but we used to go get hired together, so I don't know. And he's like, yeah, probably not a good idea, but that's just me. You know, and he started telling me about himself. He started telling me about the hopelessness that he had, that he felt, the self-pity, and just the utter and complete lack of faith and everything that had happened to him, and he started telling me about the life that he has today, and the way that he kind of told me about it and the light that he had, it gave me hope, and I had, he had what I wanted, and it wasn't the car, the girlfriend, the money, it wasn't any of that. It was the way that he talked about things. It was the light that he had. It was the way that he carried himself. It was very appealing. And anything was better than the way that I was living, because, one, I was going to die. Two, I was miserable. And three, why not? What do I got to lose? So I did it. And I took that kind of first little step on faith that he wasn't completely full of it. You know, and he said, you know what? If you work with me for a while and you don't think this is what you want, it's still out there waiting for you if you want it. You know, but I think you'll probably be pretty shocked at the results that you'll get by working the program as outlined in the book. And he held it out and showed me. And so we started working steps together, you know, and it became very apparent when we went through how it works and all the ways that we try and control and minimize and limit our drinking. That I was very much an alcoholic, because at that point I wasn't quite willing to admit it. I still wasn't sure at that point. So he showed me, based on my experiences and the questions that he asked me about things, he said, "Do you think you're powerless over alcohol?" I was like, "Well, I damn sure know my life was unmanageable. I don't know about the powerless part." And he goes, "Okay, well, we'll keep going." So we went through a couple of the chapters and stuff, and he started asking me about my experiences with things and all that. And I truly came to understand that I absolutely was powerless over alcohol. And it was not a debate, because he showed me through the book and used my own experiences to show me that I was powerless, that I could not control my drinking. And that if I could control it, I didn't enjoy it. And, you know, we kind of went on in through two, you know, and he kind of showed me about, talked to me about the higher power and all that. And when I came in, it wasn't that I didn't believe in God or higher power. It was that I didn't have faith that he could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. I didn't trust that he could work. Because in the preface to the first edition, it talks about where the idea that I just read it a second ago. I don't know. I'm gonna move on. And basically, yeah, it does talk about the idea that we got the idea that we can drink like normal people, has to be smashed and all that. And it was. So we kind of went through, and in my home group a couple weeks ago, it talked about trust and faith. I had faith. I just didn't have trust that he could do it. And continuing to kind of work through the steps and see the miracles happening for other people, it gave me faith. It gave me the ability to hold on until the miracle happened. You know, and then when I made the decision to turn my will and my life over to as God as we understood him, things continue to get better, because when I live in God's will and not my will, things work out. You know, I don't have to continue. When I run the show, everything goes bad. And I had to prove that time and time again when I was out of treatment, dating the girls after when I had like 35 seconds sober. Thought I knew everything, and I started dating the girls and stuff, like ignoring all the suggestions that I was given. And completely ignoring my sponsor advice on that one. He goes, "Okay, well, hopefully you live through this one." And I did. But it was touch and go for a little bit. You know, and it was one of those practical experiences that I used to benefit others. Because only in Alcoholics Anonymous can you... The worse you were out there and the worse stuff you messed up, the more useful you are in here. You know, and the more things that you try to do in early recovery that don't work out that you stay sober doing, are you that much more useful in helping others? Because that's what we do today, is that we basically use our experiences to benefit other people. And I've got a bunch of them. Because when I run in self-will, like, I definitely step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. And it gets interesting, you know. And then I thought the first time around that I did it wrong, so I was going to do it right. So I tried it again with the women in early recovery. And it only worked out even worse. like seriously, like, I recommend that if I had chosen to do things differently, I would definitely have avoided a couple situations. But the thing is that the experiences that we have make us who we are today. And those are the same experiences that we use to benefit others. You know, nothing is ever good or bad. It's just that when you think it is, that's what makes it so. And that's kind of a paraphrase of a William Shakespeare quote that says, nothing is ever bad or good, thinking makes it so. And some of the, like, when I kind of continued to work the steps and did my fourth step, and that I took 2 months to do, which I don't recommend anybody do, but as my sponsor put it, it gave me time to kind of live life my way. And I did. And he said, you know, when the pain gets great enough, you'll finally put, like, pen to paper and, like, get on with this. Hopefully you don't go out and drink before then. And it got kind of close for a while, you know, and I almost drank a couple different times. And it, but being at the halfway house with the guys that, like, the friends that I have now, it, being able to talk to them and to see them, and, my character defects kind of kept me around long enough to where I could actually find a solid footing to stay here. You know, so character defects, if you use them correctly, can be character assets. Because my ego and pride wouldn't let me go pick up a white chip and tell you that I couldn't do what you did. So it bought me enough time to pull my head out of somewhere, just long enough so I could kind of get a breath of air and figure out what I was doing. And I'm so glad that I did, because for, like, the first 9 months of my sobriety, I was sick every day. You know, I had, like, a condition that basically made me sick, like I had food poisoning. So I was, sometimes the best I could hope for was just hold on, don't drink, and if I was lucky, maybe eat some food and go to a meeting. And I wondered for a long time, why me? Why do I have to live this way? And kind of like an idea that I have about it is as simple as, so that somebody else can watch me go through it and see that I didn't drink doing it, so that they can see that if they have something going on, well, he was able to do that and not drink, why can't I do this and not drink? And I try to use that experience when I'm working with somebody, taking them through the book, or when I talk to somebody that they're dealing with some family issues that have come up for me personally. I relate my experiences to them so that it benefits them in a positive light, and they can kind of see that, no, I don't have to drink over this. That's not the answer. That there is hope that it gets better. And it, you know, once I kind of humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings, I had the idea in my head that they all, like, flew out at once. I don't know where I picked that up from, but that's what I thought. And, I mean, we were at a step meeting last week, and it was on the sixth step. And it was pretty cool, because if I didn't have my my character defects, I wouldn't be here. You know, so I'm very grateful that they don't all leave at once. That it's a continual work in progress, because I don't need, I'll be perfect when I'm dead. I don't even know if I want to be perfect today. Because those mistakes and stumbles that I make on the road to doing this are that much more, they make me that much more qualified in helping others. Because I can talk to them with practical experience about how a situation is going to play out more than likely. and say, hey, this is how it's going to break down. Because when I got when I was in treatment, they told me, don't date the women for a year. You'll drink and die and da-da-da. I was like, well, that's not good enough. I need to know why. What happens? How does it happen? Well, now I know because I did it. And I use that experience, especially with the job that I have, because I have a job beyond my wildest dreams. I get the ability to work for a drug testing company that puts me in constant contact with fresh addicts every day. And then they come to outpatient, and I get to talk to them when they're out halfway out in the world and all that. And then I see them and talk to them on a daily basis, and I'm like, how you doing? He's like, man, I've been running with this chick. And I'm like, oh, okay. Treatment romance, huh? And he goes, yeah. I was like, okay. Like, how you doing about it? And he goes, not good. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, this is my experiences with it. And I told him how it breaks down, how it takes you out, step to step. Because it's not you date a girl and then you drink. That it's not that simple. There's all these steps in between, and I lay it out pretty much right in front of them so that they can not make the mistakes that I made and save themselves the time. Because not everybody's fortunate enough to make it through those kind of things. But I was, and I make damn sure that I used that to help other people. And it's given me an incredible life that I have to where I practice all of these principles in my affairs, because everybody kind of, let me rephrase, if I don't practice these in all of my affairs, I won't be here. I won't stay. Because the coffee's not that good. And the abilities, I want to keep what I have. I love my life, I love myself, I love my family. Because Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the ability to create a relationship not only with myself, but I'm able to be a son, a brother, an uncle, and a friend today. And those are some of the most valuable possessions that I have. And it's one of the greatest gifts that this program gives you, is that you get things back. There are gifts of the program. The 9-step promises come true. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a beautiful program because it's a manuscript for life. You can apply it to about anything. You can apply it to that punk neighbor that puts trash in the recycling when the dumpster's right there. You know, it's given me the tools and abilities to not do what I would have done and what I would like to do. It's given me the ability to, and the understanding that if I don't like it, change it. Lead by action. Show him through my own actions how this thing works. And that's the way that I live today, because if I don't live all of these principles in my life, how well can I use that and be a sponsor and suggest that other people do things that I'm not doing myself? That diminishes my usefulness to others. And why am I here then? If I'm not useful to other people, what good am I? And it took a while, the 11th step took a little while for me, because the prayer and meditation didn't come instant. You know, I kind of just felt like I was praying at a wall or whatever. And the way that I feel that my prayer and meditation is working, not, because the way that it's working, I kind of measure, like, kind of all those little unexplainable things that happen. And if I'm doing the right things, putting in the work so that the gifts can happen, that kind of translates to me as that I am, that God is present in my life, that he always has been, that he did work for me, I just didn't work for him. And When I started actively doing 12-step work with others, you know, after I had that spiritual awakening, after working the steps, and a lot, I forgot to like when I was early on, I didn't really read the second piece of that 12-step with after the comma, where it says practice these principles of all my affairs, because I didn't for a while when I first got sober. I did all the shady things and stuff, and like I did the manipulation, I did the lying, I was dishonest. There's a couple things that I did right in early sobriety. One was don't drink, and the other was I at least called my sponsor. I may not have listened to him, but I called him. I may not have told him anything, but I called him. And when things really hit the fan, it had opened the door to be able to talk to him and tell him what was going on. And he could actually sponsor me compared to how I was, because I wasn't sponsorable because I wasn't given anything, so he couldn't sponsor me. So he couldn't be a sponsor because I wouldn't let him. And once I allowed him to kind of sponsor me and basically live the program as opposed to kind of talking about it, everything got really good. I stopped getting sick so often. I started becoming happier, and I started participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the book talks about it in the end of the book, in the chapter on acceptance. It talks about are you contributing into the situation, or are you trying to take from it? And I was a taker. That's what I did. I didn't give anything. Today, I choose to give everything that I have so that I can keep what I have. And what I have today is a life beyond my wildest dreams. The book talks about it and calls it, or says that you've been rocketed to a fourth dimension of existence which you could not have even dreamed. And that's absolutely what happened to me. Because I've got, my family is still the same as they were, and I love them more than life itself. I have friends in my life today that are my family. And I get the privilege of sponsoring other people and taking them through the book and seeing the light come on in their eyes and getting to see them participate in Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest privilege that I get in here. And it's always an honor and privilege to do anything for AA. And I didn't do that in the beginning, because I was taking. Once I started to give, it got so much better. It afforded me the ability to have a standing in which the treatment center that I went through was willing to allow me to come back to them and handle things that they want, that they needed done, and know that I would be able to be there and do them. You know, I built a reputation to where they had the confidence to do that. And one of the most amazing things that I've done in sobriety was when I went back and made amends to my parents. It was, you know, and if you ever wonder if you want to stick around, you know, don't leave before the miracle happens. I mean, the life that you can live in Alcoholics Anonymous is so much better than you could ever have dreamed. Because if I wrote down on a card or something what I wanted, what I thought I would get, even grasping at straws and putting down all the wildest things in the world that I could ever want, it would not amount to half of what I have today. And the things that I thought that I wanted don't particularly matter too much to me now. The things that matter to me now are things that don't have a monetary value. Because the cars, the money, the clothes, that's all on loan. Like, that can come and go. It's the relationships that you build, the people that you meet, and the things that you get to do that make this program so beautiful. Because if this program sucked, I wouldn't stay. I wouldn't want to. I know what miserable is like, so I can just go do that. Why would I want to be sober and miserable? Because that's so much worse. And that's what happens to me if I don't work the program, as it's outlined in the book. If I don't continue to live the program, I'm sure to drink. Like, that's a promise, and it's in the book. And the I don't ever want to go back to the way that I felt before, because I don't think I ever could after knowing that there's a better way, that you the way that you can live in here, the manuscript of life that's in that book. I don't ever want to go back to the way that I was. So I continue to put in the work, and the gifts continue to come. It's kind of how it works. Is that when I put in the work, everything works out. If I don't stress it and take it easy, the gifts keep coming. Things fall into place better than I could have ever have hoped for and planned out for. Because all my little plans and designs, they didn't work out. Because I was running the show. That was the problem. You know, it's not. And once I took away the alcohol, everything still sucked. I thought alcohol was the problem. And then I realized a little while after getting sober that no, the alcohol wasn't the problem. That was a symptom. The problem was me. The problem's the thinking. And once I realized all that, set down all reservations that I could casually drink or drink like a normal person, and work the steps, it stays good. Life is awesome. You know, like, not every day is peaches and rainbows, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. The life that I get to live today is beyond my wildest dreams. The people that I surround myself with are some of the most amazing people that I could ever meet. You know, they live this program too. They work it to the best of their abilities. They carry the message to the next person. And they show up. If I need them, they're there in a second, without a question. And I do the same for them. You know, I would do anything for them. They would do anything for me. And that's what this program teaches us. It teaches us to show up. It makes us want to be there for somebody else for nothing other than the benefit of being there for somebody else. There's no more, well, what's in it for me? That question went out the window for me a long time ago. It's, where are you? Not, what do I get? I could care less what I get. What I get is what I have already, because I keep it. So if you're wondering if you should be here, if you shouldn't be, if you want to be here, stick around for a while. You know, get involved a little bit. It is fun. So many people wouldn't do it if it sucked. You know, I mean, not everybody's that insane. So, you know, it's like the fun that we get to have today, it's amazing. So, thanks for letting me share.
Will L.